Welcome to the Empathic Mastery Show. I'm your host, Jennifer Moore, and I'm so glad you're here. This is a place where we talk about what it means to be highly sensitive and empathic, how this impacts all aspects of our lives, and we explore tools, resources, and solutions so we can shift from absorbing all the thoughts, feelings, and energy of the world around us to being beacons for calm, love, and healing.
Hey there, everybody. I'm back with a guest that I have been wanting to bring on the show and have a conversation with for a while. We've been talking about it off mic and in different places, and I am beyond delighted to be bringing my personal EFT mentor, master trainer of trainers for EFT International, Jade Barbie. And I'll just say that I met Jade, a number of years ago now, when I was training in EFT, and I went up to his place in Vermont for a level 3 training, and the rest is history. Jade's approach to healing is really beautiful, and one that I always aspire to include or to mirror in my own work. And I can't wait to have this conversation about particularly what it is to be a highly sensitive person, choosing the path of healing, both for ourselves, but also especially when we're there and wanting to be of service to other people. How do we do this? How do we hold space for really difficult stuff without spinning out, but also without avoiding it? So, Jade, I am so delighted you're here. Welcome.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be in your presence in this way and to do your show.
So glad you're here, and right back at you. So I always love to start with the beginning, you know, like the tell me about your childhood. And I love to talk about, or just kind of, you know, talk about identifying as a sensitive person, as a creative person, as an intuitive person, and just kind of like, where do you fall on that spectrum? How do you identify? You know, obviously you've got a business called Emotional Engine. And so emotions are not necessarily a stranger to you, but like, tell us about yourself. Where do you want to start?
Well, thank you, Jen. My first thought was, oh my God, I didn't rehearse this.
Yeah.
Which is probably the best way to do
that. That is
right?
Absolutely the best way to do that. I can tell you that some of the flattest podcasts I have ever conducted or interviews I've ever conducted have involved people who have rehearsed and who have their sound bites down. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully I'll never get that. Never get that. As you're asking me that, I keep flashing to where I grew up, which was actually in largely in Western Colorado. Mm-hmm. And I'm the oldest of four boys. And I grew up in the 80s. So the 80s were just a very specific time, especially for a young queer person who has never met or seen or even read about other gay people in the world. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was a very isolated time, and also a time of a lot of experimentation and a lot of kind of amazing friendships and a lot of interacting with other people, which is a very interesting thing to feel really lonely and be really kind of a sensitive person who really enjoys being alone. And then also be this social butterfly in a way. Because I think I got that from my mother. She was very much like that and it was easy with other people. And so it was very interesting to be a sensitive, shy person who was sort of socially awkward and also very outgoing. It's just like the weirdest combination. I don't know if you can relate.
Actually, I can completely relate. I can completely relate. And interestingly, my mother is very much an introvert. My father is very much an extrovert. And so I get it when you're talking about you kind of knew how to do the social thing, but at the same time, there was a part of you that was very, you know, very, very shy and very insulated. I was also thinking as you were talking about, you know, just the 80s and kind of no models for what it is to be a queer kid. How at that point in time, there was sort of everything was hiding in plain sight. You had like, you know, Boy George of Culture Club, you had Elton John, you had David Bowie, you had all of these people who were pushing up against, and then of course, you know, all the hair bands, but you had all these people who are pushing up against like the gender norms and all of these other things. But it's kind of like nobody's talking about the elephant in the room. It's, you know, so if you didn't know what you were seeing because you're a kid and nobody's told you, it's kind of like there are these people who are your allies, but you don't even know they are.
Yeah. And I think I ran up against the limits of that. There was all this representation, visual, gendered performance and non-binary kind of performances. Although I would like to say everyone was wearing suits for a number of years there. So that
there
wasn't
was
great.
That
wasn't
yes.
great. but I think because people weren't talking about it and it wasn't acknowledged culturally, everything was kept quiet and in code. And even song lyrics from that time were coded. You know, it was a real sad time in that way, I think. There was a lot of great visual stuff going on, and the dancing and the hair and the shoulder pads. And there was amazing, like I'm thinking of like Tina Turner and just people like really busting out musically.
Yes.
And yet there was, because there was this culture in the US at the time, this of repression. And I lived in a very, very white place, very, very not socially diverse, really. Had some Jewish friends. But there were even very few other immigrants in the area beyond, you know, the Caucasian folks that had pioneered, you know, people from from over the past 100 years, you know, making their way west and that kind of vibe. And so it was just very, very isolated. But one thing that was very interesting about it, Jen, was that where I lived was between two towns, and one town was very hippie and sort of people come into the Happy Valley to grow fruit and make new lives for themselves in different ways. And then there was like the cowboy town. And I lived right between them. And I lived in the crevice of this little hill where you couldn't even get any radio. So back then, if you didn't have good TV or cable TV and you couldn't get radio, you were kind of isolated. So I had this very weird upbringing. And
did you read a lot of books? You know,
I didn't. You know what I did was I walked a lot. And I spent a lot of time alone, like playing basketball, strangely. But I also had a lot of amazing girlfriends and friends who I found to, you know, do one of my major pastimes, which was laughing and having fun and just giggling a lot. I did a lot of hanging out with my friends and finding things to laugh about. And so in many ways, I was like very sort of, I had a real healthy thing going on. And yet privately, I was pretty emotionally sort of shut down and everything was kind of surface level.
Yeah.
And I think I carried that with me through, you know, challenges in my early 20s. And my parents moved to Africa in the late 80s and took my family there. It was a little bit Mosquito Coast in that way. And I sort of suddenly got sort of a wider view of the world, which was pretty cool. And, you know, was out on my own after I was 17. You know, I think there were a lot of challenges that happened in my early 20s when I realized that I really wanted to understand sort of why I behaved the way I did and what were some of my hangups, because I still had a lot of sort of social hangups. And I was starting to do computer tutoring in New York City. And that is when I ran into someone who practiced EFT. And it was coincidentally somebody who had been a go-go dancer in a band that I knew, and she had become a hypnotherapist. And it was just kind of this coincidence where I wanted to go to get some hypnotherapy to help with some sleep. What's it called when you grind your teeth at night?
I think it is literally called grinding your teeth at night, or teeth grinding.
There was a name for it. Oh, it was called TMJ. They were called something TMJ.
That was what TMJ is, the result of teeth grinding, I believe.
Okay. Well, I would wake up with headaches and all that.
Yeah.
And so I did go to this hypnotherapist, and it turned out to be somebody from this performance scene that I was involved in, and she had sort of retired and become this hypnotherapist. And I was like, aha, that's interesting. So I experienced EFT for the first time, and that was in my early 30s, and it was pretty revelatory, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
How's that for convincing 14 years and
I'm impressed. But, and I just, I mean, even though I've known you for a really long time now, I'm still kind of amazed at like, oh, you lived in Africa? I had no idea. You know,
I mostly visited.
You mostly but, visited.
Yeah, they lived there, and they were really, the rest of my family was very much connected there. But I just went to visit for holidays and things like that.
Yeah. Well, and so you, and in some ways it's like, wow, you grew up kind of in this curious kind of remote little crevice between really, you know, between sort of like very, very airy fairy, hippie, transformational, and cowboy on one set, like just that sort of the duality between, which in some ways that really sums up America. You know, it's kind of like on one side of the crevice, you got all of us, you know, kind of magical unicorns. And then on the other side, we've got, you know, I mean, this is obviously a wide spectrum. You got sort of the, you got the cowboys. And I mean, not that all, I'm using that term loosely, but.
But they were real. They were real cowboys.
Real cowboys. Yeah.
I went to high school actually. Well, I wouldn't say unfortunately. I went to the cowboy high school. Mm-hmm. So I'd left the hippie realm when I was a kind of a youngster, and then moved over to the cowboy realm because I think technically I was supposed to go to that school. So you know, you go where the bus picks you up.
You go. You go where the bus takes you.
But when there are people like you and me, sort of more expressive, like very, I would say more open, more, much, very opinionated, very sort of just high vibe people were definitely on the left side over there.
Yeah.
And that was really fun to have that connection, even though it sort of, as I grew up, I was sort of pulled more into the cowboy world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and having spent time in the oldest Protestant seminary in the country to get my master's degree, I will say, I think that there's a lot to be said for exposure to alternate ways of living and perceiving the world, that, you know, there's nothing quite like being in an environment to understand what somebody else's perspective and experience is like. And so I certainly personally have found some benefit from being in. It's hard, but at the same time, it's also, I think, really beneficial. But I was thinking, as you were speaking also about like emotional repression and just the fact that you were being raised in this really curious environment where you were isolated in a lot of ways. Like you did not have access to radio or television. You were, you know, you were in this kind of very, very sort of unique kind of pop pocket. And I was thinking about just how in that, you know, how, you know, you're kind of in like Whitey McWhiterson world, that there's a way that there is a lot of, I think, a lot of sort of emotional suppression or avoidance or kind of like, let's kind of keep a lid on this. You know, just, I mean, even kind of like the whole sort of message, 80s, 90s message of, you know, big boys don't cry. And obviously you were a very creative, very magical, very giggly, delightful person with, you know, as you said, with opinions and kind of outspoken. But I was just thinking about that sort of socialization of like, don't be too much.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think internally was my self-talk, you know, don't be too much, you know, don't be too much for your family. Don't be too much just in general. And I think that stayed with me. And I think that kind of repression, you know, it needs to be addressed. And I think I was really aware, you know, later in life that I needed and wanted to address it. And that being kind of in performance world and showbiz, which I was kind of in my early 20s, I wasn't going to get it there. I wasn't going to have, I don't know, deep conversations necessarily around emotional truth and things like that. And I think I was longing for that.
Yeah. I was just thinking, it's like you're having a conversation with somebody about something that's really important to you. And they're like, oh my God, my nylon's got a run in it. it's that there's just this way that there's not the space for that deep emotional expression. I'd love, there's two places or the two things I want to go to, because I'm hearing in some ways we are kind of being like the ship is steering itself towards the conversation, because you and I were talking off mic before we got on the interview. I turned on the recording about just even within the healing world, the fear of emotions, even within the healing world, the ways that people try to modulate and control and contain feelings. And so I'd love to talk about that, because that is definitely a passion, I think, of both of ours. But I'd also love, before we start there, I'd really love to talk about or have you lay out your philosophy on healing. Like, you know, could you, in 5 minutes, Jade, explain the meaning of the universe to us. But, you know, just where do you, like, what's your take on it? What's your sense of it? I mean, obviously you experienced EFT, and there was definitely, I'm sure there's like an entire novel between the first time you had a session with this EFT practitioner hypnotherapist and where you are today. But I'd love, and we could certainly cover some of that material, but what I'd really like to hear from you is like, you know, what does healing mean to you? What does being a practitioner mean to you?
Yeah, I will try my hand at that. In some ways, I think it's kind of an easy question, because when I grew up in Colorado and with my family, my mom was Catholic. And so she had all that Catholic stuff going on, even though she wasn't practicing particularly, but she had a lot of the qualities of Catholic, which is, you know, sort of stoicism a bit and quiet and sort of
it gets baked in. My mother was a recovering Catholic and ex-Catholic. Mm. I wasn't raised around it, but it's there. You can't escape it.
Yeah. Sort of guilt. I could feel guilty with a look. Let's just
Did she do the silent treatment?
She didn't. What she did was, and I haven't actually had much of a conversation with her about this, but, you know, back in the day, I think I was a bit too much, like too expressive and too sort of like out of the box and too much really for her in some ways.
For her.
I pushed her gender buttons. I pushed, sexuality buttons and things. And so I think there was an element with her of, you know, what will the neighbors think? How would I even talk about this? I think I bumped her up against her limitations in a way. Mm-hmm. And my dad was he was very quiet and sort of the opposite, but he was a drug and alcohol abuse counselor. And he was an expert in what we call capacity building, which is really helping people help themselves. And he really modeled that as a therapist and as somebody in the world, because he did that in Peace Corps. He did that for USAID later overseas, is helping people find their own solutions to things. And he always talked about that. And he was always talking about that. And of course, and he also was in musical theater. You know, he had a lot going on. But that sort of environment was, I think, very, you know, it impacted me in a way. And so to answer your question, I think that all healing is self-healing.
Yes.
I really believe that. And I think that when I think about the work that I do now, which is one-to-one EFT sessions with folks, or if I'm talking about EFT with students or teaching a class in EFT, whether it's kind of the basics and the foundations or really talking about the nuances of this work, which I love, what we're doing is we're helping people kind of hold space for themselves and connect the dots for themselves and to experience the benefits of being present to their own emotional reality, their own discomfort, their own fears, their own worries, to gain, you know, a left brain, gain wisdom around that and understanding, and at the same time sort of experience what it's like to allow yourself to really have discomfort.
Yes.
And not push it away.
Yes.
Or run away.
Yes.
Or other ways to suppress it, or, and maybe learn that, oh, I'm afraid of my feelings. Oh, that's what this is. I'm afraid. And it hasn't been okay that I'm afraid. And maybe I could say that out loud. Or I'm really angry. And then maybe it's okay to just be angry. You know what I mean? And have the benefits of having those feelings. In some ways, EFT is very simple that way.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's what I love about it. And I think that's why I've been doing it, you know, and talking about it for, you know, at this point, 18 years.
Yeah.
It's about 2005. Yeah.
It dawns on me that even though you and I know exactly what EFT is and talk about it all the time, that there may actually be some listeners who are coming to this interview for the very first time and don't know what EFT is. So, Jade, can you tell us what EFT is?
Sure. EFT stands for Emotional Freedom Techniques. It's a self-applied, I call it a form of mindful acupressure.
Yeah.
Where you touch or tap with your fingertips on the endpoints of acupressure point, acupressure meridians on your body. And there's only about 9 of them, give or take a few. And it's essentially 9 points in the same sequence. And as you kind of touch those points, you tune in to essentially what's wrong or what feels kind of off or that going on in your body, and maybe put some words to it. And as you say those words and you tap those points or touch those points, you're allowing yourself to have your emotional discomfort or whatever it may be, that thought that feels true. It could be something as intense as like, I'm a bad person, or this happened, or this happened. And as you kind of sit with those words and those thoughts and you tap, the pain and the intensity kind of drains out of it.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very structured approach to holding space for ourselves, and also therapeutically for holding space for others as well.
Yes. Thank you. Well explained. Well, and you were, in terms of this idea of holding space for emotions, as we were talking before, I was thinking about, you know, so many empaths tend to perceive other people's feelings, or more than perceive other people's feelings, absorb other people's feelings. And I think that there's an interesting dance that happens for a lot of us, where we are so accustomed to, maybe because our family system, maybe because of the culture we've grown up in, doing the emotional heavy lifting for other people. And also this idea that being a healer or being a practitioner or being involved with another person's healing means jumping into the middle of the pool with them and kind of feeling all the feelings. And what I've personally noticed is that when I learned to be comfortable, or more comfortable, sitting with my own discomfort, sitting with my own distress, and being present with what was true for me, it made it a lot easier for me to be able to sit with other people's discomfort and hold space for that without the need to fix or to rush into rescue. And I'm really hearing in what you're talking about, the difference between simply being present with what is going on and what is true for us and holding space for that, versus looking for the solution, trying to fix the problem, like trying to make the emotion go away, like, oh, you know, I'm feeling all this grief, bad thing, should stop it. So just really, you know, but really thinking about like that difference between just so many of the models in the world of like, let's find a solution, let's rush into rescue, let's make this better, let's not feel these hard feelings, and the way that you approach EFT.
That's an astute point about the difference between maybe trying to make it better or even advice giving or having an agenda for fixing versus kind of meeting a person where they're at. And that includes ourselves. You know, we're, you know, having a practice of meeting yourself where you're at is not necessarily the easiest thing in the world. It's something that I think is an ongoing practice for me, for sure. And yet, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. When you can do it for yourself, or when you have that habit of valuing that at least and reaching for that and just kind of acknowledging, oh, I feel really uncomfortable. What if I just allowed myself to have that for a few minutes and see what happens?
Yeah.
Rather than, I don't know, you know, pretending it's not there or doing some sort of old, maybe childhood strategies of pushing it down, swallowing it down, protecting other people from it, you know, whatever that is, right?
Or the spiritual bypassing kind of stuff, you know, the light washing stuff where it's like, you know, and within the world of the greater world of tapping, you'll see examples of this, of happy tapping, you know, it's like, even though I'm feeling like absolute, you know, total, I don't know, like horse puckies, I you know, I choose to feel surprisingly okay about this. I choose to be happy right now. I choose to let the light in, you know, like just the ways that sometimes people will just go straight for the affirmation, straight for the, I choose to feel better about this, and not necessarily just sit with the feeling first.
Oh, I think it's an epidemic of that. But I think it comes from, if I can put my finger on it and sort of diagnose, I think some of that comes from fear that if we really allow ourselves to feel right, that maybe we'll be swept away or the bigness of it will take over, or I'll be right back there where it happened, or I'll just be overwhelmed by it. Right. Yeah. So we come up with these strategies to sort of, what did you call it? Light washing. Throwing, when I do my trainings, I talk about that old commercial where a kid walks into a room and he's like, "Mom, it smells like fish in here." And she sprays some air freshener and he goes, "Now it smells like fish and roses." And it's fish and roses, right?
That. Because, oh my goodness.
You get fish and roses if you don't take the time to actually clean the wound and clean up the garbage and really just be with the mess and kind of engage with it before putting a Band-Aid on it or before, I don't know, even opening the windows. You know, you can open the windows, but you need to engage with it and sort of get into it a bit and clean it up. And it's the same as like dressing a wound. You wouldn't dress a wound before cleaning it out and treating it fully.
Exactly.
Otherwise you're going to get an infection.
Well, it's just such an interesting phenomenon that we have right now in the world where it seems like there is so much like, do I really have to do the thing? Do I really have to scrape that? You know, it's kind of like, do I really have to like scrape the pot and deal with this stuff that's baked on here? You know, and I mean, we live in a disposable culture. We live in a culture where so often people are just kind of like, oh, it's dirty, it's broken. Let's just go, you know, throw it away and buy another one. But human emotion doesn't necessarily work that way.
True.
You know, you were saying about sort of just the fear of emotion. And I was thinking one of the things I've heard so many people say over the years is like, if I let myself cry, I'm afraid I'll never stop. And I think that that's kind of a similar thing. But we were also talking about the way that even it's not just about us as individuals, as humans feeling our feelings, but, you know, one of the things that you've noticed being a master trainer of trainers and having conversations with people is that this is a phenomenon that doesn't just stop with us as individuals, but also can reflect in the way we approach healing. And that, you know, just this way in which not only do we sometimes avoid feeling our own feelings, but we might be using strategies to avoid feeling feelings with the people who come to work with us.
Yes. And I think why I said it the way I said it before was, I think you're really onto something when you talk about being able to kind of hold space for your own stuff. You have that deep knowing of what's possible. And sort of when you say EFT could help with certain things, you know it can because you
know it
experienced
can.
And you're kind of practicing what you preach, right? You're
right.
Or at least you're shooting for the stars, right? And that's really important because, you know, nobody's perfect here. And yet we're so perfectly, some of us can be more perfectly suited for this work. And I think that that's kind of what we're talking about a little bit, is being uniquely suited to help someone hold space for themselves, but to not necessarily fall into their story. And at the same time, facilitate it in a way that's a safe and appropriate, and at the same time doesn't run away from the hard stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real, it's a real interesting balance, and I find it very, it's so gratifying and so essential, I think, for us to find a way to have that experience for ourselves, as well as to facilitate that experience for others when we're
absolutely interested. Well, and you know, this really, I mean, this is like a whole, like, woo, there's a can over there that I'm going to open with the, you know, take with a can opener, is just, you know, and you and I've talked about this over the years about the, you know, the practitioners who do their work and the practitioners who don't do their work, or who, you know, train in a modality and think it's really cool and sort of pull it out of their toolbox, but clearly have not necessarily used it for themselves and don't necessarily know like how this works. And I have certainly encountered people who were like, oh yeah, I did a seminar, a weekend long seminar on, you know, on EFT for my clients. And it's like, okay, but have you done it for yourself? Well, no, you know, and it's just really interesting to me that, you know, the thing sort of the, I don't know, I may be biased having grown up with two parents in human services, but it seems to me that there are the healers who do their work, and then there are the healers who do the work for other people. So I don't know, maybe as a way to avoid doing their own work. Or, I mean, I'm not necessarily going to, I mean, I don't know why they don't do it, but it's just interesting that there are those of us who are like committed to doing the work. And then there are those of us who are kind of like, yeah, I'm going to go help those other people.
Right. I, what's coming up for me as you're talking is, I think when we're sitting with somebody else, the pull, and I don't know if this happens for a lot of EFT folks, but it does for helpers and for people who are trained in different modalities and who are maybe trained counselors and things, is that we're trained a certain way to hold space, and they're trained within certain rules and or a certain, what's the word, like a lineage almost, or a certain kind of, you know, based on who our mentors were or who
they are.
And, you know, how are well, the rules that we play by. And I kind of come back to what is the kind of that EFT or that EFT lens, like a pair of glasses or that EFT hat. You know, my students are very familiar with me because I always wear a hat. And that we are in this role of an EFT practitioner. And this is why I love training EFT and just kind of working with other trainers and helping them be better trainers and teachers. And of course, practitioners as well, is that there are very clear rules to the role of being an EFT practitioner, or to working with this lens or this tool or this hat on, that you can kind of always kind of come back to. And one of them, of course, is to help somebody be really, you know, be really client-centered with somebody and really work with their words, you know. And that in some ways is the antidote to a lot of the internet tapping that you see out there, where there's a lot of tapping scripts and, you know, people are doing their best kind of to come up with a way of engaging their audience, right? And giving them some words to say, to learn how to tap and things like that. But the best kind of tapping, as we know, is the words come from us, right? And it's our own unique subjective experience of whatever, either whatever happened or whatever we're going through. And to be wearing your EFT hat, you're going to listen for something that somebody says and sort of discern, you know, wow, maybe this is a place where I could just help this person sit with this for a minute. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if I don't know, or it seems there's any question, I can just ask, hey, does this feel like a good place to do some tapping and see what happens? I hear some intensity there. What if we just put these words into the tapping and do that? So it's real. It's so client-centered. And in a way, if you're doing EFT well, as you know, we're kind of batting the ball back into their court, like a tennis metaphor. And so you can't play tennis alone. You have to play with somebody else for it to kind of work. Although I guess you could use a wall, but we're dealing with another person, right? So you're hitting the ball over to them and they have to hit it back. And it is very empowering to the person to go through the motions of hitting that ball back to you. Now, of course, they can choose to not hit the ball or walk away. But if we're doing that, we're not trying to do their work for them, right? We're not playing a tennis game in front of them and expecting them to learn or experience anything. People, all learning is self-learning, right? Healing is self-healing. And I think that when we're doing EFT well, we're kind of staying, the long answer to your initial question about 30 minutes ago, is to, we're staying out of the story a bit because we're letting them have their story. And we're helping them have their story in a very structured, like moment to moment, very gentle kind of way where they don't have to go back into the details. We can just work with their relationship now to what happened then and just sit with that and see what happens as a result of just being willing to have that complicated relationship to that thing that happened, that traumatic event. And if we remember that that's our role, it's one of the antidotes, right, to falling into the story or taking on too much or feeling too much. And one thing I wanted to add, Jen, because I know it can be a pitfall for people who are really empathetic and feel with, I find some of the toughest EFT to be with friends and people that I know, like family members, because I call it like a lot of, there's a lot of static there because you have a lot of a kind of an agenda. You have a whole relationship with them that informs what you're doing. And it makes it a little bit difficult to be in that role with somebody. Although I have found myself in that role. And I think some of the most difficult times I have as a sensitive person is feeling like I want to heal them. I want to help them. I want them to not be in pain, which is totally, I would never do with a client necessarily. But yet with a family member or a friend, you kind of feel what that's like again, and actually how in some ways unhealthy that is. And it's sort of a warning to step back and remember like, hey, you know, I'm not a therapist here. I'm not a practitioner here. I'm your friend or I'm your family member. And to remember those boundaries and remember that distance and to remember that it is their job.
Right. To be with and I think that that thing, like so many of us who were the sensitive feeler in our families, took on the assumption and the role that it was our job to do this, that it was our job to do the emotional heavy lifting, that it was our job to feel the feelings that nobody else was willing to admit that they that were going on in the house. And one thing I've definitely noticed is that when we are not comfortable sitting with uncomfortable feelings, we will rush to rescue because we feel better when other people feel better. And I think, and like you said, you know, like you might be able to have that sort of client focused, agendaless willingness to just be present with somebody wherever they are without like the, my goal is to make you not feel this like 10 of headache pain by the end of the session. I mean, that would be nice, but you know, that we can do that with a client. But then, like you said, a family member or a close friend shows up and all of a sudden we're kind of back in that emotional enmeshment. But I keep on coming back to just the core idea of letting go of our agenda.
Right. Remembering that it's literally their job. Their feelings are literally their responsibility.
Right.
Not ours. Right?
And yet we have such a culture of emotional avoidance and emotional denial. And so many of the people I've interviewed and so many people I know who identify as empaths have been the ones doing the emotional work for people who did not want to do that work. I mean, I think that there's really is a deep core level of getting, it's not my job to do this work for you.
Mm. That reminds me of that article, which there's an article called The Victim Triangle by Lynn Forrest. And it's based on the Cartman drama triangle. And it just reminds me of when we might be in that place of thinking it is our job to rescue someone or heal them or something, is to remember that sometimes we're getting something out of being in that role.
Yeah.
Right. We're, there might be a one up, one down relationship that we're, that is, you know, maybe soothing our self-esteem in some way to be the one that knows, or the one that is the helper, or the one that is the healer. And it's really important to have that self-awareness of that pitfall, because it really is a pitfall that can happen. And which is why it's so important to have good boundaries and good professional hygiene, right, around working with clients. And it's not, you know, it's not easy, especially when we don't have a ton, you know, there's some, probably some good role models out there. I've definitely had a few, but it's not always easy. We kind of have to experience what it's like to kind of not do that well in order to know, then this is how I'd rather feel. This is how I would rather it be. Right. So but that relationship, it's almost like that victim triangle article is so great. It's because it's about not being in any of those roles with anyone, whether it's rescuer, victim, or perpetrator, which are all victim roles, until we step back and go, oh, wow, I can take responsibility for my feelings, which means maybe I can let you take responsibility for yours. And then we can have, then what could happen if we do that, you know, and what kind of freedom could we actually have? What kind of emotional freedom could we have?
What kind of world would we live in? Like, I mean, let's just, you know, I mean, we're talking about like two, I don't know, it starts with like you and me sitting here having a conversation, both willing to own our own feelings. But it really feels to me like this is the $1 million, I don't know, like this is the multi-billion dollar question for the planet right now, is like, what would this world look like if everybody could take responsibility for their feelings instead of kicking the can of trauma down the road until they decide that they need to, you know, invade a country, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That brings up a session I had with a friend. And what was, you know, I typically don't do sessions with friends. It usually only happens when the person's in trouble and I love them so much. I just want to sort of be proactive and offer them, you know, something that they might be able to connect with to help them feel better. But the self-awareness, and I think that the emotional, and I don't, you know, I don't have a good definition of this, but now I'm starting to think I probably need one. The emotional intelligence that comes from really acknowledging, okay, I'm feeling a certain way and it's really scary. And then you kind of sit with that, feel a certain way, and allow yourself to feel how scary it is as well. And then noticing your thoughts about it, which is, it's not okay that I feel this way. Wow, it's never been okay that I feel this way. Okay. And you sit with that for a minute, right? And you start to see kind of how things relate. And maybe you remember that experience of doing that and you'll do it again, right? Or you'll see that the next time it happens in a relationship with someone where you're triggered and you go, oh, wow, that's really activating an old wound within me. You know, this person isn't making me feel a certain way. I'm feeling a certain way because this is really old. Mm-hmm. Yes, this person's behavior is very triggering and terrible, but there's something going on inside of me, right? Trauma is what happens inside us. And that's what's going on inside of me is what I can really be curious about. And I think as we, and again, just kind of do that more, maybe then we are starting to take more responsibility for our feelings and our roles in different actions that we take. And maybe that's a beginning point, I guess, is my point, Jen, is like when we start to just develop a relationship to ourselves and our own feelings and our own history in terms of it's mine and it is what's happening inside of me. Yes, it's being triggered by what's happening outside, but it is what's going on inside. And maybe I could just be with that and hold some space for that and feel what that's like, which, you know, I'm told when I work with people, as I'm sure you have, is that it can be the scariest thing. as we said, to sit with some of that stuff, because it is very dark. Yeah. And it can be very scary. And it can be very, we've built up a big energy in relationship to it, a lot of fear around it, right?
So maybe around it.
Well, with the fear first, you know?
You know, and that's the thing I'm realizing as you're talking is that there's like, there's the emotion, but then there's all the stories and the narrative and the feelings and the resistance and the anxiety around just even the fact that the feeling is there or that something is going on. I mean, it's just, there are so many, it's so nuanced when it comes to that willingness to be willing to feel our feelings. And as you were speaking, I was also thinking about the difference between they made me feel that way and something in me got activated by the behavior of that person, and just really understanding how that all works. Like,
right, connecting the dots for yourself around why you're, maybe with a why, right? That left brain understanding of why do I always behave this way? Or why am I feeling so crazy right now, right? Or why, you know, and the, maybe the why isn't as mysterious, right, as we may have thought.
Right, right.
Because we're getting to know ourselves better. Yeah.
Yeah. So we are getting to that point in the conversation that we always come to. And this is just always, and never, there's, it just always feels like when we get to this, the 50 minute mark, I'm always like, oh my God, I can't believe how fast the time has gone by. And again, I can't believe how fast the time has gone by. And I, because I really feel like the wisdom that you are talking about right here, I mean, at the very core of it is just the willingness to sit with our feelings, the willingness to let other people sit with their feelings, recognizing what's ours, what's not ours, and not taking on the, not doing that emotional heavy lifting, but also having the emotional intelligence to recognize when, you know, as David, my husband, will say, it's like you're having a $75 reaction to like a $5 problem. Yeah, I won't go into the story about moldy oranges because I completely lost it when I reached into the refrigerator and touched an orange and my fingers went into it and it was just a rotting orange and I just lost it. But my reaction, I don't even know what my reaction was coming from, but my reaction was disproportionate. I was very gone. I was very, it was very disproportionate reaction. But just noticing that.
Yeah. And that's so powerful that it, even those of us who work with this a lot and, you know, who are aware of a lot of these connections, you know, we're human and we get swept away.
Swept away. Oh, yeah.
It happens. Oh, yeah. And hopefully, yeah, you know, you learn when you're swept away to, you know, I don't know, maybe not send that email, right? Maybe not have that conversation. Maybe take a step back and and do some, I don't know, self-care strategies, right? To sort of just bring some attention to it, bring some compassion, which I think grows from this work as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, just being able to hold space for ourselves and others with loving kindness as opposed to judgment or resistance or, you know, that let's find a solution, let's fix all of this really quickly. I was also thinking as you were speaking that just, you know, it's like there's an incremental journey that we go through. Like, I know that there would have been a time in my life where that moldy orange, I would have been processing it for a week. I would have been like the impact, the fallout of it would have been like it just would have cascaded. And I would probably still just be in it. And, you know, I definitely lost it. I completely lost it. And at the same time, I was able to reboot fairly quickly. And I think that's the other thing is that as you were talking, like even as we're works in progress, we're still working on it. We're still coming to understand it. It's like, maybe we're not in that, we're not like down in the pits for as long. Maybe we didn't get knocked unconscious this time that we, you know, that it's a what do they say? You know, progress, not perfection.
Right.
So,
well, I was going to say, Jen, real quickly, is that when you, what else is that when you when you do that, also, and we rope other people into it, right? We maybe explode at somebody else.
Yes.
And I'm not saying you would do that with the oranges necessarily.
Oh,
but
no, I did. I did. I was just, it was definitely a, you cannot buy any produce ever again because you cannot keep track of it. And that's right. Mild. Yeah.
Right, right. But then we get feedback from others, which can be on a spectrum of sort of mild and, you know, hurtful to terrible. You know, yeah. And violent, right? And it can breed. And that's where our emotional health and our emotional landscape inside is so, I think it's such fertile terrain for where to begin with some of these larger world problems. And I, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that that's why I love the work that I do, is that I think I love, I guess, seeing the fruits of, I don't know, taking responsibility for myself. It's not always comfortable. It's not always easy, but it certainly makes my relationships feel a lot better. And it makes my interaction with the world feel a lot more healthy than I think it ever used to be.
Yeah. You know? Totally. Yeah. Totally. Well, and as you said, you know, you don't necessarily know why. I think about the miracles I've seen with EFT and how when we change our behavior, things shift and change externally as well. You know, I've heard stories about like people are having an issue with a boss or with a family member or something. We tap on it and then they come back a week or two later and they're like, oh my God, after we finished tapping, you know, so-and-so quit their job, or my boss came in and apologized for being cranky and gave me a raise, or, you know, my family member, like the issue, just like they saw there's part in it and they made it better. And I feel like it's like we can keep the focus on ourselves. If we can do the work for feeling our own feelings, that allows us to be more resourced. It allows us to be more resilient. It allows us to make choices from a place of calm clarity as opposed to amygdala hijacked reactivity. And ultimately, like, and that means that we can set boundaries, we can set limits, we can say no, we can recognize what's right for us, we can make better choices. And I believe that that ultimately will and can ripple out into the world in a way that truly can change the world. That's my take on it.
Yeah. Amen. Inshallah.
Amen. Yeah. So like anything else, it's like, I really would kick myself if I didn't say this.
I think I keep coming back to that friend that I was working with and the feedback that I received from her. She was having a real problem with somebody she lived with. And really what it kind of came down to is that she allowed herself, you know, with me, together with me, and I helped her do this, to just be angry and have this difficult emotion that I think she had a very difficult relationship to. You know, we didn't get into it all.
No.
But just, I could just hear it in her, in the tone of her voice. You know, it's sometimes she was crying and she couldn't express in words. And I just kind of let her do that. You know, I just helped her just sit with that and be with that. And, you know, it wasn't very long before she was starting to make these connections and just say, like, I've never, maybe she said, maybe in my whole life, like, it's never been okay to be angry. Mm-hmm. No, and she's somebody who's my age, right? Mm. And it's just these revelations are there for any of us if we are kind of brave enough. I would say maybe to have the courage or take a chance on finding a way, and EFT isn't the only way, but it is a good way of sitting with what is, so that almost it facilitates this beautiful, like, stepping back, so that you're no longer standing too close to a painting anymore. Yeah. And you kind of step back and you can see the fullness of the painting. It's like almost like what starts to happen when we stop maybe fighting against how we really feel or what we're really having, and just have that, as you said, that willingness to have it even for 5 minutes, which is the pre-frame I sometimes use with folks. What if I was willing to have this with Jade for 5 minutes? you know, and it really is quite the benefits of that, as we know with EFT, because sometimes just after a couple of rounds, things can change. I think that's actually what we're doing, is we're having a willingness to sit with something uncomfortable, and then that energy can move and evolve.
Exactly.
And I just saw that with my friend, and it was so beautiful to see her kind of step back into her empowerment, where at the beginning of the conversation, she just felt so disempowered. And she also expressed to me how a couple of friends, an ex-partner, her therapist, you know, really fell into advice giving with her.
Yes.
Because I think they felt the pressure to fix it. And yes. I'm sure they felt the pressure from her. She felt the pressure to fix it too. But I came into it with a mindset of, oh, we're just going to sit with this hard stuff.
Yes.
You know, and that's my job, right? And that's what I love doing, is helping people find an experience in that that's really like, oh yeah, that's pretty cool, what it's like to sit with the hard stuff. And because it's not as scary as it seems like.
Oh, the willingness to sit with the hard stuff is just, I mean, what is it? You know, that willingness to sit with the hard stuff, and then the miracles that happen when we are willing to sit with the hard stuff. And I really love the question you asked, you know, what would it be like to sit with this for 5 minutes? You know, what would it be like to just let it be okay that I'm feeling this way for 5 minutes. Great question. I mean, maybe one that hopefully the audience can take, our listeners can take, and just be like, oh, I'm feeling this thing. What would it be like? Instead of like, how do I find an affirmation that's going to make it better? What would it be like to sit with this?
Yeah. Sounds like a good place to.
Yeah.
Good place to wrap it up, right?
I could go on and on and on with you. There are so many things, so many jewels, so many wonderful parts of this. Yeah. So I love to do this little time travel exercise, or I don't know, it's more like magical spell at the end of every episode, because I honestly believe that podcasts exist outside of time. They live on a server. And they will be heard for many, many, many years to come in the future. But also there is a way in which, you know, any, like when we drop something in time, it ripples out on both sides of the river. And so I really believe that not only are we sending this broadcast into the future, this broadcast is going back into the past. And you and I are able to go back to a time, maybe in Colorado, maybe in Africa, maybe in New York, maybe in Vermont, who knows where. But we can go back to a place where younger Jade really needs a message, really needs something that you now have that you know they need. And so the way I love to do this is, it's not, you know, not what I would tell him this, but I'd love for you to speak directly to younger Jade. And so my questions for you are twofold, is sort of like, who, what, when, what are we going back to? And I'm like, where in time, who in time are we going back to offer a message to? And what do you say? What are you telling them?
That's so good, Jen. I see immediately, I see them, and I refer to my younger self as them.
Them, yeah.
I'm non-binary identified, even though I kind of say he, they, but for my younger self, it's very much a they, because I think that that's honoring of kind of where they were at, especially at that time. There just wasn't a word for it. And what I would say to them is that, like, it's okay to feel all of the things that you're feeling. That it might not be okay with other people. It might be really scary for other people to feel and to think the things that you're feeling, or to express those things out loud. But you're allowed to have and express and feel and sort of, you know, fantasize about or all of the things that you're thinking and feeling. And the world will catch up to you. It will.
The world, it's okay to feel what you're feeling, even if other people don't get it. And the world will catch up with you. Jade, this conversation has been so rich. I hope that others have been inspired by you know, this conversation and inspired to really be like, what if it could just be okay to let other people feel their feelings? What if it could just be okay to let myself feel my feelings? So last question, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, that's a great question. I have a website and you can get in touch with me on emotionalengine.com.
Emotionalengine.com. Excellent. And you have a very limited social media presence in terms of like, I think you might have an IG or something, but definitely. Oh, and people can also find you over on the EFT International website as well.
That is true. Yes. Yeah. But I have, I kind of use my website as a lighthouse, and it's a place where I do a lot of writing, and that's where I put videos and things like that for EFT and just to share my perspective on this work, which is uniquely my own, and yet, you know, kind of shining the light out there and see, you know, who needs to see it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I will say, as somebody who's worked with Jade for many years, if you are looking for the an impeccable experience with the level 3 EFT training, Jade, really, I've learned so much from both being a student in his trainings and then also having the privilege of being able to be an assistant in his trainings as well as time has gone on. So check out Jade. He's awesome. Jade, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great. And you're so good at this. I love it.
Thank you.
I love this for you.
Yeah, I love this for me too, actually. I really, really love interviewing people and having these conversations. It's just so rich. And we all need to be sharing our stories more. I just really believe that. You know, I mean, I had no idea you lived in Africa for a period of time. I've known you for years and years and years. Like, it's just amazing the things that come out when we just have a conversation. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
As we come to the end of this episode, I'd love to hear what you're taking from this show. Please jump over to empathicmasteryshow.com to leave your comments. In the show notes, you'll find a link to grab your copy of My Empathic Safety Guide, 3 Basics for Finding Calm in the Eye of the Storm. And while you're there, please subscribe and follow this show. And thank you for your help sharing this show with the people who need it. Please help me to spread the word and send this podcast to friends or family members who need support living as highly sensitive empathic people. Then join me again when the next Empathic Mastery Show airs. Okay, one last time. Hop over to empathicmasteryshow.com for your empathic safety guide. And until next show, shine on. We need you and your gifts here on this planet. So please don't judge your empathic rainbow by colorblind standards.